Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We're in the F as in Foxtrot section, and the next one in the list is FFTW. That's the fastest Fourier transform in the West. That's what that stands for. It is obviously a library for Fourier transformations, for Fourier transforms. And a Fourier transform is a mathematical process for converting or transforming one array into another. I don't know if array is the correct word, but the examples that I've seen have been, or I guess the clearest examples that I've seen have had to do with sine and cosine, like waves, like sine waves. So for instance, let's say you're trying to, for whatever reason, you need to convert a sine wave to a square wave. And in order to do that, you essentially need to understand what frequency of those peaks and valleys that you see in a sine wave, right? If you picture a sound wave, for instance, you probably, whether you spend a lot of time in, I don't know, Audacity or not, you probably are vaguely aware that a sound wave, for instance, is a series of sort of hills and valleys, or said another way, it's a series of hills and inverse hills, if you know what I mean. Because when you've got a hill that goes up, 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 it ramps up, and then starts ramping, starts going down, then it hits sort of like sea level. It hits that zero point on your Cartesian graph, and it does the same thing, but in reverse, right? It ramps down, as it were, to this sort of dip, and then it starts ramping back up, and then it's back at sea level, and then it ramps back up into a hill, and then down. So in other words, there's not really any valley. It's just a hill followed by an inverse hill, an upside down hill, followed by a hill followed by an upside down hill. And I say it that way because I think that sometimes if we call a sine wave sort of peaks and valleys, then you forget that there's an inverse peak. It's just a valley that bottoms out at zero. And that may be true in some applications, but generally if you know, like without any kind of gate or limiter on it, you do have this sort of negative version of the positive underneath the zero marker on a Cartesian graph. So you've got this sine wave, hills, negative hill, hill, negative hill, hill, negative hill, and you want to convert that into, for instance, a square wave. I mean, it could be something else. It could be a sawtooth. It could be something else, but let's just go with square because I think that one makes the most sense. So if you think about all the hills, not the negative hills, not the inverse hills, just the hills that go from zero to some quantity above zero, and then they cascade back down, and then they cascade back up. If you just think about sort of the volume of the hill, of each of this some number of hills within a space, then with Fourier transform, you could figure out what kind of frequency you need to add to that sine wave in order to sort of cause it to fill the square that you want to create. Now, if it's a steady wave, if it's just a steady tone, then that's a pretty predictable thing. Like you can figure out pretty easily how to convert that steady, constant tone into a square wave or a sawtooth wave or some, you know, whatever, from its sort of natural state of being a sine wave. But when that volume is all over the place, like my voice, where the sound wave is sometimes very high, sometimes very low, sometimes a great frequency, sometimes not so great of a frequency. Frequency meaning how many sort of hills there are compressed into a given amount of time. The more hills there are, the more frequent there are that there's movement in the sound wave. The fewer hills there are, the less frequent or the lower frequency there are on how many times that sound wave sort of moves within a given amount of time. So the Fourier transform can figure out mathematically, and there's like a formula for this. You know, you could do this by hand, and I've seen someone do it by hand. You can figure out with the formula what it would take, what you could add to your sine wave to fill it out into this square space, and that's a Fourier transform. And the significance of a Fourier transform is that when you can find the difference between different sound waves, then potentially you have that there's a lot of things that you could do between those two occurrences, like noise removal, for instance. A lot of that has to do with Fourier transforms, because the computer can figure out the difference between the sine wave that produces a background noise, or I should say a noise you have decided you don't want, and the noise that you decide you do want. It can figure out the difference, and then again, once you have that difference, then you know, or the computer knows, how to restructure those sound waves to minimize or remove some kind of sound. And interestingly, it turns out that this isn't, you know, a sine wave for me is the more obvious example available, whereas it's actually the application goes far beyond the sound waves in Audacity, for instance. And you can find application for this in, for instance, shape recognition, in facial recognition software, things like that. The way that the computer, quote unquote, knows the difference between a circle and a square, for instance, is by sampling points on a graph and figuring out where they intersect or what properties they share, and then it's able to potentially, you know, given the correct the appropriate programming, it could tell a circle from a square, for instance, or certainly the outline of eyes versus the outline of a nose or a mouth, and things like that. So the Fourier transform is the foundation for a lot of kind of pattern recognition within software. So it's a big deal, and it's something that requires quite a bit of processing power. The FFTW library claims to be the fastest Fourier transform in the West, and that means that it's a collection of fast C routines for computing the discrete Fourier transform in one or more dimensions. It includes complex, real, symmetric, and parallel transforms, and can handle arbitrary array sizes efficiently. Okay, array was the correct term. FFTW is typically faster than publicly available FFT implementations, and is even competitive with vendor-tuned libraries. That is the claim being made. And I say it's a claim because I have no way, well, I'm sure I have some way, but I have not tested that. So I assume that it knows of what it speaks. So the actual package includes FFTW-Wisdom, FFTW-Wisdom2Conf, FFTWF-Wisdom, and a couple of other variations on that. So those are the commands, but I think probably a lot of people are probably using more than that. They're using the library itself, which of course is included as a bunch of FFTW.so files, as well as some CMake configuration files for, you know, if you're developing with this stuff. The commands FFTW Wisdom and all of the different related sort of variations of that, it's an interesting process because Fourier transform, Fourier calculations, I guess, it's a pretty intensive process, apparently, because, I mean, if you look at the equation for which this is all, upon which all of this is based, there's a literal infinity sign in it. Like it takes the sum of sine and cosine waves, both real and imaginary, from infinity to infinity, or something like that. It's got big sort of conceptual implications. So, and I don't know what real, you know, I mean, obviously, it says infinity, but I mean, obviously people can solve for it both by hand and on a computer. So it's, you know, yes, it's for infinite space, but obviously we're dealing with finite values ultimately, but it's still very intensive. And there are, you know, if you want to do it efficiently, then you can use what FFTW calls a wisdom file. And a wisdom file is simply kind of a, well, it's pre-calculations for certain sizes, for certain dimensions, with basically, as I understand it, all the possible values within that selected range. But there's the added benefit that the wisdom file is compiled on a specific processor. And I couldn't find documentation exactly, I mean, without reading the source code, which honestly, I probably wouldn't understand anyway. I couldn't find exact documentation on what the variables here are, but I'm assuming that if you process it on a specific processor, then obviously there are various instructions available on a new high-speed processor that might just not have existed on older ones, or there might be shortcuts on system when transferring, I don't know, memory from, you know, the South Bridge to the North Bridge or something like that. I don't know exactly. I couldn't find like a bullet list of like what exactly an optimization in a wisdom file consisted of, but there is some good documentation on the concept over at cse.usf.edu, and I'll link to that in the show notes, because there's a really interesting document on what a wisdom file sort of enables FFTW to do. As I say, it doesn't go into really deep detail of what actually is being like, what's the deciding factor on what an optimization is. But it does explicitly say that if you build a wisdom file with FFTW-wisdom on, you know, like one processor, like let's just say an AMD processor, like whatever, and then you take that wisdom file over to your Intel machine, then it might still work. You know, you could still be using that wisdom file, but you're not getting any of the optimization. And I guess technically, I imagine there would have to be some things that just wouldn't work. But maybe not. Anyway, that's what a wisdom file is. It's just pre-calculation. It's being compiled by a computer. And I tried generating one, and it just took too long, even for just a 4x4 range. So FFTW-wisdom-V for verbose-C for, I've already forgotten, FFTW-wisdom-C for canonical. That's right, -- canonical. So optimize and pre-plan a canonical set of sizes, all powers of 2 and 10 up to 2 to the 20th, which is something like 1,048,576, including both real and complex, forward and backward, in place and out of place transforms. Also includes 2- and 3-dimensional transforms of equal size dimensions. So it could be like 16 by 16 by 16. It'll take hours if you try something like that, just warning, fair warning. And then -O for output, and then put it into like, you know, a wisdom file called, I don't know, my wisdom or something, and then space, and then the area that you want to pre-calculate for. I tried a 4x4 because I thought that felt pretty conservative, like 4x4, that doesn't seem like a whole lot. It's a lot. It'll take a long time. So do something really, really small if you want to try it for yourself. It's not required, you know, like, and it might not be worth it if you don't do a lot of Fourier transforms yourself, if you're not programming something or using a library that would invoke Fourier. I mean, obviously, if you're using it on another application, like in GIMP or in Audacity or something like that, then that's, you don't, unless you go in and modify the source code to look at your wisdom file, That's not really something that's available to you. So this is exclusively for someone writing a dedicated Fourier transform, and you want to optimize how quickly it runs. Then you could, in advance, run fftw-wisdom, get yourself a compiled wisdom file, and then point to it in your code. And again, machine specific. You wouldn't want to do that and then distribute your wisdom file. That would not do any good unless all of your systems are 100% the same. Next one in the list is FluidSynth. This one is near and dear to my heart. I love this application. This is an amazing little synthesizer of sorts. It's really more of a sampler because it has everything to do with sound fonts. So sound fonts are interesting because they are sample-based. It's a sample-based synthesis method, meaning that you're not constructing sounds from pure sine waves, sawtooth waves, things like that. You're recording something and then using a computer to transform it into lots of different pitches and speeds and things like that. So FluidSynth is the component that can handle that part of it, the playback part of it. So the idea is that with a sound font, you take a brief sample of something, you save it as a wave file. So it's uncompressed, it is encoded as a wave file. In theory, that's quite a large file size, but sound fonts, they're quite early in computer synthesis, really. Like they came around pretty early on, so they, you know, well before even, I don't know, 5 megabytes was considered a small file. Like, they needed to be really small. They needed to be smaller than that. And these days, you couldn't find a sample library that's 5 megabytes, or really 1 gigabyte is often a conservative estimate for really, really good sample libraries. SoundFont is not really, really good sample library. It is the bare minimum. You want a very specific tone. Well, you get a sample of that tone. Now, if it's a percussive tone, then it may be short anyway, right? I mean, that's not that much to sample. But if it's something that you want to draw out, like a string instrument, and you want it to simulate a bow being drawn across a string for several seconds, then that would be a very long sample. Well, in SoundFont, you don't do that. You take a sample of it, and then you just you program your SoundFont to auto loop that little sample. And with good sound wave editing, finding the zero crossings, things like that, you can usually often mimic the effect of a long drawn out tone successfully through looping. Does it sometimes sound like a mellotron? Yeah, sometimes it does, like a tape loop. You can kind of detect sometimes the loop point, and you think, that's not someone drawing a bow across a string for 3 seconds. That is someone drawing a bow across a string for half of a second, looped for 3 seconds. So that there are weaknesses of sound font, and I recognize that, and doesn't matter to me at all. A good sound font has a couple of different effects to really trick you into not noticing the loop points or the fact that you've really only heard a brief moment of a sound and the rest of what you're hearing is just a little bit of artificial reverb to make it sound like it's being, you know, like it's lasting longer than it sounded. So there's an art to sound font, and I think that's the component of it that I like possibly the most, and also I'm a big fan of tape loops and the mellotron and things like that, so I don't really mind that sort of, you know, almost intentional, I mean unintentional at the time, but now that we're, you know, 20 years after the invention of sound font, it's got a quality to it that I appreciate. But what I really appreciate about sound fonts is that they are very, very low investment, let's say, way to get a wide variety of tones that you just wouldn't necessarily have access to otherwise. And I think that there are a couple of different camps in synthesis, probably a lot of different camps in synthesis, but broadly, let's just say there are two different camps in sampled synthesis. And one is, well, let's take sampling technology and use it to represent all possible variables in an analog sound system and see how close we can get. And when you do that, you see sample libraries that literally are several gigs large, and they have samples of things, designed to sort of switch over depending on what you want. So if you need that long drawn out bow across a string, then maybe they'll have a longer sample for that. I mean, it'll get looped eventually because there's no way of predicting all the different lengths of time that you might want something drawn out, but it'll be a longer sample. And then if you know that you just want a quick, sharp little tone, then it will be a separate sample just for that. For pianos, you often see separate sample banks for depending on the velocity, is that right? Velocity of the key press. Are you banging down on the keys, or are you lightly tapping the keys? And there's a different sound sample for that. It's not just the same sound at a higher amplitude all of a sudden because it detected that yes, you actually hit that key harder than earlier. So there's that theory, and the theory is that you're going to really just capture all those variables. You're going to try to make your sampled library as true to the physical performance of an instrument as possible. The only difference is that you're doing it on an electronic keyboard that's sending MIDI signals, but that your sample library is reacting differently based on some parameters of your MIDI data. Higher note velocity means a different sample gets called than a lower note velocity. A longer key press means that a different sample is going to be called compared to a tap, a quick release key press, and so on. The other camp is sort of, I think, like the sound font sort of theory, which is close enough is good enough. And I have an appreciation for that kind of like recognition that this is synthesis, this isn't the physical world. These are electronic instruments that you are hearing, and here you go. I understand both camps, and I respect both camps, and a lot of the video game music that you hear these days is possible essentially because of the first camp, the let's mimic the real world camp of synthesis. Like those 30 gig sample banks out there, orchestra in a box type of like libraries of sound, I mean, that enables a composer to compose essentially orchestral music like you would hear at the cinema for a video game, where the budget is much, much lower than, certainly the budget for music is much, much lower than a big screen movie, but they can still get that the sound and the feel mostly of an orchestra. Can you tell the difference? Yeah, probably. I mean, if you go listen to the soundtrack for, I'm trying to think of something, Pathfinder Kingmaker versus the soundtrack for Kingdoms of Amalur, you'll know the difference. They both sound great, but Pathfinder Kingmaker was clearly composed on, or even, well, who cares? Pathfinder Kingmaker, obviously composed with samples. Kingdoms of Amalur, obviously recorded by an actual orchestra. You know the difference if you know what to hear, if you're listening for it. But the admission that you're just tinkering around on a synthesizer, I respect that. I like that because, I mean, ultimately, that's what a lot of us are doing. We're just poking around on a synthesizer. And so I quite like the sound font concept. And I love that you can get, for instance, a piano library for 852 kilobytes. Actually, that's not a piano. Sorry, that's not a piano. That's a cello. Piano library for, here's one. For 656 kilobytes piano. I mean, and they vary, you know, there are different sound fonts created by different people with different sample rates and different different lengths of samples and different number of samples. At its most basic, like if you're getting a 652 kilobyte piano sound font, you're realistically probably getting like one one sample. Someone pressed a key on a piano and recorded it for half a second, and then turned it into a sound font. They dumped it into a program and said to the program, "That's your sound. That's the bass sound. Here's the frequency." Is this, and therefore it is this note on the keyboard, and you can find that out in, I mean, you know what key you pressed on the piano, but you can also find that out in Audacity. You go to the change pitch function, and it tells you the current frequency of that note, and so you take that, you put it into the program, now everyone knows what the bass line is, and then the sound font application knows that when FluidSynth, for instance, asks it to, or when FluidSynth knows, when it takes that sound font, it imports that sound font to play a tune with, it knows that the bass note that it has access to is, let's say, a middle C in this example, and then in order to get five steps above that to a G, it needs to play it, instead of at this frequency, it needs to play it at that frequency instead. Simple. So a really basic sound font is going to take exactly one note and just calculate the difference between this note and that note and play and just increase the frequency or decrease the frequency, whatever it takes to change that pitch. As you can imagine, outside of maybe a single octave, you can kind of start to tell that that's what's happening. So a slightly better sound font might include different samples at different octaves, so that at least you're basing your differential on something closer to your target. So for instance, I've got a sound font for a Roland piano, which contains something like 64 samples, and that's 6.9 megabytes, so 7 megabytes. So that I guess is considered pretty large for a sound font. I mean, they can get larger, but generally, that's kind of the range you're looking at, like maybe a megabyte up to 10 megabytes, something like that. And how do they sound? Well, I think they sound really good. Like I say, I'm not picky, so I think they sound amazing. I think they are just great little quick and easy ways to get just those different tones into your music. And yeah, you're not fooling anybody, probably. You're probably not making anyone think that you broke out your actual guitar and a sitar and your violin or your cello. People are probably hearing the difference, but I don't know. Like, are you ashamed of doing synth music? Then yeah, I guess maybe don't use sound fonts. But if you appreciate the fact that you're using synthesizers for what they are, then I don't know. For me, I think that's a valid reason to use sound font. FluidSynth is the component in all of this that plays a sound font. It's not the only component. That's not the only tool that you could use to play sound fonts. You can use MuseScore. You can use LMMS. You can use QTractor. No, I'm sorry. Actually, QTractor uses, I think, a FluidSynth plugin to play it. So yeah, so FluidSynth, MuseScore, and LMMS are the LMMS might even use FluidSynth as well. Yeah, so in other words, FluidSynth is pretty important. Like, it's a really great little, it's the, like, if you were out at a music store buying synthesizers, FluidSynth would be that rack unit that loads in samples and plays it back at different pitches as desired by your keyboard. And that's what FluidSynth is for your digital rack as well. It's that little, that's that unit where you load a sound font into SF2 file, and it understands its bass note. It does all the calculations to figure out what note it needs or what frequency it needs to play to get to a certain target note, and it plays it back. And you can try it for yourself. It's the command is FluidSynth, and then a path to a MIDI file with MIDI data in it. -A for your audio output, and you could do Pulse Audio, you could do ALSA, you could do a file, F-I-L-E. File will just, instead of playing it out to you, it saves the playback, the sound, to a WAV file called fluidsynth.wav. in your current directory. So whatever you want to do, -A pulse audio, you hear it right there, -A file, it goes to a file and you can play it later. And then a path to a sound font. The sound font is loaded by FluidSynth and the song is played back to you. When this is happening, you are dropped into a Fluid Synth prompt, and there's a bunch of stuff you can do there. This is a synthesizer, so you can manipulate what you're hearing, what's being played back. So for instance, if you have a sound font with different sound banks in that single sound font, like I said, there are different sort of complexities of sound fonts. Some sound fonts just have one, you know, a note that gets played back at different pitches, but others have options to them. You might have a sound font that conceptually mimics a specific thing, like, I don't know, a violin, but within a violin, you've got different sounds you could produce with a violin. You've got pizzicato, you've got tremolo, you've got, I don't know, normal. And so possibly there might be different tones that you could, a different sample set you could trigger within that sound font. So from within the Fluid Synth prompt, you can type in, for instance, prog 1-2, and that looks at whatever's loaded in at program 1, but to load the sound bank, the second sound bank within that program, for instance. So there's quite a lot you can do to sort of manipulate how you're hearing a MIDI file back. And a lot of MIDI files have different instrumentations all within that MIDI file. And because there are MIDI channels, and a different MIDI channel can be assigned to a different instrument. And this is all encoded by a standard called General MIDI, and it's something from like 1 to 128, or is it 0? Is there a 0? I don't think so. I think it's 1 to 128, and they're all, it's 128 general instruments that you might expect to find at certain channels. You don't have to follow that spec, but you can. And if you do, then if someone has a General MIDI sound font or a General MIDI setup, then they can download a MIDI file and expect that what appears on a specific MIDI channel, a general MIDI channel, you know, for instance, might be a piano on that channel. Well, no matter what piano you have available on your system, as long as it's on that MIDI channel, then it'll play that piano sound. So you get generally the same experience regardless of your setup. And Fluid Synth, well, Fluid Synth doesn't, I don't think, really cares about that. That's just general MIDI. So if the MIDI file has been encoded, has followed general MIDI sort of specifications, then you can assign your MIDI instruments, your sound fonts, to the appropriate channels and get a playback that makes sense. This is really important for percussion, really. Like that's one of them that you really want to get percussion on the percussion channel, because otherwise you just hear seemingly random notes, usually completely off key, because you've got, I don't know, your piano assigned to your percussion channel or something like that. But Fluid Synth will play back MIDI files, in short, and it plays that back for you live instantly or to a file. Okay, definitely time for some coffee. Let's go get some of that. We'll come back for Free Cell Solver. Are we back? I think we're back. I have my coffee. This is, again, the Big Cozy, which is a name I absolutely find hilarious. The Big Cozy is from Flight Coffee New Zealand. If you're ever in New Zealand, be sure to stop by Flight Coffee. I've never been there. I just get it mail order, and it is very good coffee. Highly recommended. So let's see. This is, in fact, I should say that Big Cozy might be not my new favorite. I still, my favorite is still, what's it called? Milky or something like that? Milky Bomb or just Milky? I don't know. Whatever that one is. But this one is nice. It's a deep flavor, kind of rich. Tastes like coffee, you know? And I think it's kind of, it's taken the place of, I think it's called Bomber. Bomber was okay, but now that I've tasted Big Cozy, it's kind of taken the place of Bomber. Unfortunately, Big Cozy is a seasonal one. They are only going to sell it during the winter, apparently. So I better enjoy it while it lasts. Next in line is Free Cell Solver, and this is a pretty complex one. It's got both a library, libfreecell-solver.so, and a bunch of commands. And the commands, I don't play solitaire. I should. I think I'd probably enjoy it, but I don't play it. And so a lot of this is completely foreign to me. I don't know how it works. I don't know how you could tell me how to solve it, and I still wouldn't understand the game. So whether that's useful or not, not entirely sure. Probably not. So I know exactly as much about Free Cell Solver as I've read in the README files, and the simple entry point is fc-solve. That's the primary command probably that people would use. For it, though, you need a board state. And now the board state can be expressed just in a text file, and presumably it could be of varying complexities. So the one that they give in the sample has about eight rows. And 7 columns mostly, and then it sort of shuffles down to 6 towards the end. So, yeah, 7, 7, 7, 7, and then 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6. So, and the notation is relatively self-explanatory. There's 4C, that would be 4 clubs, 2C, 2 clubs, 9C, 9, 8C, QS, so that's Queen of Spades, 4S, 4 of Spades, 2H, 2 Hearts, and so on. So it's an array of things, and to solve that you do fc-solve-p for parsable output, and then mycell, you know, dot cell or whatever, mycell.board or whatever you've called your mycell.txt, whatever you've called your thing. You might want to pipe that out to less or more or most, and then it shows you the board state of each step that you would need to take in order to solve the thing. And this, I mean, this is like something like 137 steps is what it outputs. But it is, you know, it's just like chess output. It's just letters and numbers, and you can kind of step through it and view the different states of your board until you've solved it. So I'm gonna, in real time here, I'm gonna try modifying my cell.cell such that it only has 4 rows of data, just to see what that does to the efficacy of this solver, because that might not be a valid board state. That might never happen. So that is not a valid board state, I guess, in a free cell board. I guess you must line out all the cards at the beginning, because it does look like it wants all cards to be present. So there you go. That's Free Cell Solver. There are a bunch of other commands: Free Cell Solver Parallel, Free Cell Solver Multi-Thread, and so on. They don't take board states, though. They take start and end values and step values. You can view a lot of those, or sample uses of those, in the shell scripts included in user share Free Cell Solver presets. There's like 20 scripts, and look at those and you'll see all the sample data. I don't understand that data. I couldn't find documentation about it that I understood. So I'm not sure what those are useful for. Probably they're very interesting. I just don't know enough about solitaire for it to make any sense. I have no context. So if you do play solitaire, specifically Free Cell, I guess, then that might be of interest. It's a fascinating sort of, it's fascinating that someone thinks, that someone has that designed. I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, certainly if you were programming Free Cell, I can imagine you would love to use that library for a solution, because obviously if you know the correct solution, then you can alert your user that a move may not be good, or you could provide a hint move feature for your player. So I imagine that would be a very useful library to have as a developer of Free Cell, I guess. But it's beyond my understanding, because I don't play that game. Next up is FreeType, which is a free, high-quality, and portable font engine. FreeType is a free and portable font rendering engine. It has been developed to provide support for a number of font formats, including TrueType, Type 1, and OpenType. It's designed to be small, efficient, highly customizable, portable, while capable of producing high-quality output. It's freetype.org. This is the big font library for your system. Like, this is a big deal. This, you know, when we say a font library and a font rendering engine, what that really means is that there's a thing out there that knows how to look at specific files called, you know, TrueType files, TTF files, and it knows how to decode that data and render what it's trying to describe. It's no different, really, than a library that knows how to decode, for instance, a JPEG file, or a PNG file, or even like an HTML file. It knows how to look at some data and produce the thing that that data is describing. In this case, it's a bunch of glyphs. It's letters and numbers and so on, symbols. Now, along with that, there's a bunch of other things. There's the automatic kerning that's being expressed. There's aliasing to make them look smooth. There's the size of the glyphs. The specific font being used to fill in those glyph spaces, and so on. It's obviously a really important library to have on a computer. You'd want that. There is the ability to just paint pixels in shapes of letters, and that does work. We've seen that in the past. It's perfectly suitable. In fact, it is still suitable for certain terminals. Like, that's all that a lot of terminals use, is just the ability to render output as letters. That's a pretty common thing. You're not loading FreeType every time you log into a text only console of a server, but once you get that GUI up and running, you want the pretty fonts, and that's the thing where FreeType steps in and provides. In this package, there's a bunch of header files in case you need to use FreeType in your application. There, a lot of that is going to actually be taken care of by your framework, so a lot of times you won't consciously be using FreeType, but you might need it for something specific. And then there's a library that does the actual work, and there's some lines for the profile.d for a login shell, and it just exports an environment variable. Next one in the list is Freeor plugins. Freeor plugins, and I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. I don't think there's a way to pronounce it correctly. It's F-R-E-I-0-R, and so let's call it Freeor. These are video plugins. They are ways to affect a video file, or a video stream, I guess. They're intended for like video editing. They're not intended as like live effects, although they can be wrapped up as live effects. But yeah, you're gonna see them in things like KDN Live and Shotcut in what's the other one? FFmpeg even can use Freeor plugins. FlowBlade can use it. That wasn't the other one I was thinking of, but that is another one that can use them. So they're effects that do things like introducing fake VHS artifacts, introducing fake dust specks to mimic a film reel or film footage, probably a desaturation filter, I would imagine, transforms, cropping, things like that. Some of those may exist as Freeor plugins, some of them may not. I'm just actually rattling off effects that I can think of from KDN Live, and not all of those are Freeor, but a lot of them are. They're there, Freeor, and they do funky things with video footage. Some of them are really, really useful. Others are, you know, you can only assume are highly experimental or sort of just for fun. And I can't quite imagine what you would do with them. But when you're talking about plugins and effects, there's always the question of, well, what is not useful? Because, I mean, there are some that are clearly useful. Like some plugins, it's like a very common thing, like a chroma key, which Freeor, as far as I recall, does not have. You can kind of think of that being obviously useful. Like, most people are going to expect to find a chroma key effect in a video editor. Whereas other things, like a, actually that's really useful too. I can't find a non-useful one, but, well, here's a hard light effect. Or here's a defisher effect, like a presumably to defish eye footage. I mean, is that really super useful? Maybe for like that one time that you accidentally shot something with fisheye and want to reverse that. Is it going to be perfect? Probably not. Hue shifter, is that going to be totally useful? Here's a letterboxed effect. I mean, is that useful? I mean, it might be for an effect, but I mean, it's not really letterboxing your footage. I mean, it is, but it's also not. Emboss, that one probably not super useful. Edge glow, not very useful. So there's a lot of different effects, and I think that there are probably varying degrees of usefulness, but like I say, my point is that what exactly is useful, what's not useful. Like when you're trying to achieve an unexpected effect, then suddenly these weird oddball ones become kind of useful because you find something that alters your footage in an unexpected way. So you try it, and then you combine it with another effect, and then you combine that with yet another effect, and suddenly you've got something really unique that's kind of the greater of the sum of its parts. So even the seemingly sort of, you know, student project, like here's how to make video footage look different, even those can sometimes be really, really surprisingly useful, because really all you want to do is distort this footage and put it under some kind of randomizer and then apply a color filter over it. Now you've got a cloud effect that you wanted to make, you know, so you don't care that it's that some of these are completely destructive to the footage, because that's what you wanted. And again, others are really, really obviously useful, like alpha top, alpha gradient, alpha alpha over, alpha zor, all those kinds of like compositing effects, like that you would just expect, you would just think that that should be in a video editor. So Freeor is super, super useful if you ask me. Like, I don't know what video editing on Linux would look like without the Freeor plugins. And again, not saying they're all clearly useful, and some of them, I guess what I'm saying is that some of them, you look at your list and you just think, why is this stuff cluttering up my list? Wouldn't it be better if I just didn't have those options? But then on another day, you think, I don't have enough options here. I need more Freeor plugins than what I have. So they're really, really amazing little plugins with varying degrees of immediate usefulness, but they're a lot of fun to mess around with. And if you try Kdenlive Live and try some of the effects on there, I mean, some of them will, if you don't do them right, then they look useless. You know, if you're alpha overing nothing, then that doesn't seem very useful. But if you're alpha overing a motion graphic that you want to insert into a thing, then maybe that is useful. So you do sometimes have to do the thing correctly. And Freeor doesn't provide a whole lot of guidance. You know, it's pretty raw input and output in terms of the UI. I think Kdenlive Live does a little bit to cushion that, but I think they're, you know, it could probably be done better. But it's a great set of plugins. It's a big value add for video editing on Linux. Next up is FreeBIDi, FriBidi. It's a Unicode bidirectional algorithm library. What does that mean? Well, to do a right-to-left language like Arabic or Hebrew, then you need something to figure out how to make that look correct on a system, and that's one of the things that's what FreeBIDi does. It ensures that you're able to do a right to left language output and make it look you know, like people would want it to look. This is, I mean, I can imagine it would be really, really important. I've never tried to do right to left anything, but just thinking about designing interfaces and user interfaces, just going from left to right and trying to make sure that it looks okay when it's being resized and so on, that's hard enough. But imagine now adding in that the complexity of, oh yeah, and I also need to account for a system in which all of this is being rendered from the opposite direction. That's got to be tough. There is a command called FreeBIDi, and it has the ability to parse a file containing strings and converts a logical string to visual, which I don't really know what that means, but that's what it does. It you could do, for instance, echo hello world into hello.txt and then do FreeBIDI. Let's do a force right to left, which I think is dash dash RTL. Yeah, dash dash RTL hello.txt. And you get in the right, from the right hand side of your terminal, the string hello world. So that kind of gives you a small indication of what this does. But I know that there's a lot more here that I'm not using. I don't know, due to the fact that I've never used a right-to-left language before in my life. So FreeBIDI is just the command interface to the FreeBIDI library. And obviously the package's primary offering, I think, would be the FreeBIDI library itself for use in your programs when you are trying to account for right-to-left text. Last but not least is Fuse, or libfuse. No, it's just Fuse is the name of the package, which contains libfuse and a command or two. I think fuser mount is contained in this package, and something about user lock management is included in this package. So Fuse is essentially an attempt to enable the users to create and interact with file systems without having to fiddle around with the Linux kernel. I mean, the kernel is still being involved. It's bridging a virtual file system to the thing that is being mounted. So there's still interaction there. And from what I understand, Fuse is a set UID root. So there's a privilege escalation happening when Fuse is being used. But the advantage is that when there's the Fuse module in a kernel, then that module exists, and it can understand drivers written for Fuse, and that's huge, because otherwise, anytime you wanted to mount a file system that you hadn't remembered to compile into your kernel, or that wasn't available in the kernel, then you wouldn't be able to access that. It just wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be a thing you could do unless you could get that driver, compile it into your kernel, and then use that. I guess you could, you know, compile it as a module and load it into the kernel. But all of that, that's root stuff. Fuse says, okay, the root user of this system is comfortable enough to include a Fuse platform. And on that platform, you can build and interact with drivers for additional file systems. Fuse sort of translates that file system to something that the kernel recognizes dynamically. There are a lot of drivers out there for Fuse. The one that we just talked about a couple of episodes ago was CryFS, that the encrypted file system that you could use to store your data on someone else's computer is the big use case. You put it into this little encrypted vault, a CryFS volume, and you put it anywhere, and it doesn't matter. People can't get to it because it's encrypted. And that library, if you do an LDD on user bin CryFS and then grep for Fuse, sure enough, it's using libfuse. And that's why when you create a CryFS volume, you're just doing it as a normal user. You don't do this as root. You create it. It gets mounted at some location within your file system, and all of that just kind of happens for the user magically. The command fuser mount that is included with this package is not very useful. I mean, it's probably useful for something, but it's not super useful as far as I can tell. Fuser mount options mount point. I couldn't get a mount point to mount with fuser mount, and every example online only ever used fuser mount to demonstrate unmounting a file system. How did it get there? Nobody knows. So that's kind of puzzling. I couldn't figure that one out. I think as commands go, though, I don't know that that's the feature of the Fuse package. I really think that the feature of the Fuse package is right there in the URL of its source. It's libfuse. Like, that's the big feature here. Libfuse.so. That's the thing that's enabling Fuse driver. Drivers written for Fuse to operate, to function, and those are the commands that you're going to use, probably. CryFS, I think SSHFS is a Fuse library as well. Is that even a thing? Do I have it? Yeah, I do. LDD, probably user bin, SSHFS. grep fuse. Yeah, that's another one. So SSHFS is something that's written for fuse. So we can mount a file system, a remote file system, over SSH because of fuse. So it's a huge, huge deal, and it's something that it's one of those things that ideally you don't even recognize. You don't realize you're using it. It's just a magical thing that your computer does, and you might momentarily think, oh, cool, it didn't even prompt me for my root password. But generally speaking, you won't even think about it. It's a way for you to interact with your computer easily and with peripherals easier than before, having to do everything as root. That's fuse. That's all the F packages that we have in the L section of Slackware. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.